From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the American press, coverage of the uproar at the UN Conference on Racism in Durban, South Africa, has been uniform. The conference was thrown into disarray when the American and Israeli delegations walked out in protest of a harsh anti-Israel declaration linking Zionism with racism and genocide. From the New York Times to the Fox News Channel, the controversy was framed as an extreme and inflammatory rhetorical gambit led by a bloc of Arab nations. But what about elsewhere in the world? How did the Durban debacle play out in the international press? Joining us now is Martin Walker, Chief International Correspondent for United Press International. Martin, welcome to OTM.
Hello.
The events in Durban have given us a sort of deja vu to the 70s and the non-aligned nations movement. And that's how it played out in the U.S. press. Was there a similar reaction in the European media?
No, it's been a very curious reaction in Europe. The European press has been accustomed to being particularly critical of the United States and particularly critical of President Bush in person. And you'd have thought that this decision to walk out of the conference at Durban would have invited the usual kind of American bashing. And it hasn't been like that. In fact, what's been really remarkable is the degree to which an awful lot of European opinion, even moderate left opinion, has been understanding the American line and in some degree actually supporting it. I was really startled to read the editorial in France's Le Monde, which is a very left-of-center publication, a very distinguished one, in which it attacks the attempt to conflate Zionism and racism by saying, coming from Arab states, which in questions of the rights of man have no lesson to give to anyone, the maneuver is a mixture of absurdities and hypocrisies. Now, that's a remarkably strong statement from Le Monde, but it's something that we've had echoed in various other normally centrist or normally slightly critical of American newspapers as well. And I've also been struck to note that in an awful lot of the African press, and particularly in the newspapers of Uganda and of Kenya, we have seen furious attacks upon the Arabs for what they claim is hijacking a conference that was meant to focus upon the sufferings of Africa and conflating it into the Middle Eastern conflict. In other words, it looks as though the world media opinion is being very much more sympathetic towards the United States than I would have expected.
When Le Monde and the Times of London agree editorially on anything, it's striking. Does this suggest some sort of globalization of opinion that the marchers against the IMF and the World Trade Organization have somehow missed?
I think maybe you have a point here, because it wasn't just that newspapers like The Times and The Conservative Telegraph in Britain, The Conservative Frankfurter Allgemeine in Germany, and Die Presse in Austria and Le Monde in France were all taking the same line, although that is pretty unusual. It's also that they were using very much the same kind of arguments. And it was a realization, I think, that there are some kinds of common values which, despite all the family arguments, Europeans and Americans do tend to share.
Was there any notable exception to this chorus of support for Israel in this case?
There were one or two interesting dissident voices raised. For example, Britain's Independent said that the American withdrawal was actually triggered by its fear of facing massive reparations claims for slavery from African Americans and not by friction over language used to describe Israel. And Britain's Liberal Guardian said that the U.S. government, quote, marched out looking self-righteous without once having had to talk about the deep racial problems in America. But in some ways, I think my favorite comment was one that came from Dagens Nyheter, which said that the real tragedy was that Durban, a city in South Africa which had seen the real triumph over apartheid, had to be the arena for this extraordinary display of international hypocrisy, which wasted a chance to say something serious about racism.
Absent the walkout, do you suppose that the European press would have paid any attention to the Durban conference at all?
Oh, absent the American walkout, I think it would not have got below the fold on page 17. In a sense, Colin Powell's decision not to attend personally and then to withdraw the U.S. delegation was what made the Durban conference into a major international media event.
Very well. Martin Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is Chief International Correspondent for United Press International.
Recently, there was a dust-up on Capitol Hill when Ernest Hollings, South Carolina's junior senator despite his 35 years in the job, was prodded by a local paper to say something unseemly about the senior senator, Strom Thurmond. Hollings said that Thurmond was, quote, not mentally keen. Such blunt assessments of brain power in Congress are very rare, and we wondered why the Washington Press Corps, usually game when it comes to reporting on the financial or sexual or alcohol problems of elected officials, seems so much more fastidious when it comes to questions of basic competence. Tom Oliphant, the Boston Globe's longtime Washington columnist, joins us now. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be with you.
Let's talk about this issue of competence. There was a wonderful episode involving the Washingtonian magazine and Senator William Scott.
Indeed, there was. This was one of those ranking stories, you know, who's the best X or Y. This was who is the most stupid senator. And Senator Scott came out number one in this poll. What we still remember about the episode 24 years later, though, is that the poor fellow actually called a press conference.
Well, I seem to recall the seminal quote from that press conference was when Scott said, "There are plenty of people here who are stupider than I am."
Indeed. In fact, another of his colleagues a decade before that, the late Roman Hruska of Nebraska, once argued that one of President Nixon's Supreme Court justices should be supported despite the fact that he was generally seen as a mediocre judge. And Senator Hruska said that the mediocre people deserve to have spokesmen and representatives, too.
You're talking about Herbert Carswell.
Indeed, we are.
Now, these are a couple of notable examples, but I see them somewhat as the exception that proves the rule. Why is it that we can now report on alcoholism, say, or we can report on sexual peccadilloes because they both arguably can affect the effectiveness of an elected official, and yet we can't talk about basic competence and mental acuity?
What occurs to me is that this, what you called fastidiousness about issues of basic competence, is, I think, a vestigial practice here. And the way it was explained to me when I first came to Washington at the end of the 1960s was that we leave people alone as people unless something that they do as people can be seen directly as impairing their official functions. And beyond that, the only other thing that would trigger Washington, anyway, press activity would be something that showed up, say, on a police blotter or a hospital admission form or, say, divorce papers, some official act. I mean, I can think of two words to make my case about how our institution has changed, and those two words would be Gary Condit. No one has made a direct or fact-based connection between the disappearance of this poor young woman and anything that the congressman did, and that hasn't restrained the feeding frenzy. And yet we have this hangover that keeps us from, say, having a feeding frenzy on the issue of whether somebody is a doddering old fool or not.
Okay, so being muddle-headed does not have to open you up for criticism.
It's interesting how we have not, as an institution, gone the entire mile and started delving into people in ways that I think are impossible to quantify as well as to define.
In other words, you can't quantify or define incompetence or dim-wittedness.
Indeed. And also, you know, it may be philosophically for a second that it's impossible to make a case for its importance. I'm thinking here about what are the things that a public official does that are the most newsworthy. I mean, if you're a senator or a congressman, it's how you vote on the issues that come before you. The fact of the matter is, intelligence as we understand it, or wisdom as we understand it, is not really at the core of what produces a yes or a no.
Well, you actually made the rather original suggestion that perhaps being intelligent isn't even necessarily a qualification for the job of sitting in Congress. Reminds me of a line of Gilbert and Sullivan where one member of parliament tisking at the affairs of another said, this is what comes of being of two capacities. Thank goodness I am a person of no capacity whatever.
There it is in a nutshell. The only thing I could throw back at you would be the observation of the great Woody Allen that, what is it, 80% of getting by in life is just showing up. Which is why perhaps so many congressmen and senators put such great importance on their attendance records.
Tom Oliphant, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tom Oliphant is the Washington columnist for the Boston Globe.
This week in Denver, a federal jury awarded more than $500,000 to TV newsman Dave Minchel, ruling that he was fired illegally because of his age. Denver-based KMGH Channel 7 plans to appeal, sticking to its story that the award-winning reporter, nicknamed Deadline Dave, was canned because his scripts were ungrammatical. OTM is gratified that at least one station categorically refuses to split its infinitives. So, free of charge, we offer up this promo for use by KMGH 7 News.
KMGH Denver, your number one grammar news station. To whom do you turn for breaking news, weather, and sports? KMGH. Our field reporters carry a copy of Strunk and White.
He was described by neighbors as a loner, meaning a person who keeps to himself, as opposed to a person who arranges loans, or the colloquialism for an item lent out temporarily while another is repaired.
KMGH, for breaking news coverage second to no other station which offers such coverage.
The situation here now, Brad, is that I have agreed to exchange myself for the hostages, and I have to report that the gunman is growing quite aggravated.
Be careful, Steve. Only situations can be aggravated. People are irritated.
In every sense.
Transitive. Intransitive.
For every tense.
Subjunctive. Pluperfect.
KMGH. Continuously active in the newsroom, continually passive in our construction.
As for the salad bar proprietor, no wrongdoing was alleged.
KMGH, your grammar news leader.
Coming up and back to reality, the price of reporting on everyday death and a witness to the massacre at Attica.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 30 years ago at the Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York, there was what could be called a collective failure of humanity. After a prison uprising, the inmates took 42 hostages and prepared a list of demands, including less pork and more fresh fruit in the diet, the freedom to worship and communicate with the outside world, and amnesty for the riot that had taken place, in which one guard was killed. The inmates called in observers to oversee the negotiations.
We want Huey P. Newton from the Black Panther Party, and we want the chairman of the Young Lord Party. We want Clarence B. Jones of the Amsterdam News. We want William M. Kunstler, attorney at law. We want Tom Wicker of the New York Times, Mr. Wicker.
New York Times columnist Tom Wicker was asked to observe and eventually mediate the conflict, but there would be no mediation. On September 13, 1971, state troopers stormed the compound and shot a barrage that left 29 inmates and 10 hostages dead. Tom Wicker is on the line. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, this Sunday, Court TV is airing a documentary on the event produced with your help called The Ghosts of Attica. Can you explain how you functioned as a mediator at Attica?
Well, I'm not sure we did function. We tried hard. We had no real power, but the state officials would allow us two or three times during the course of a four-day weekend to go in and consult with the inmates. So, in effect, we were almost messenger boys. We'd carry messages from them back to the state officials and vice versa and try to get some kind of dialogue going between the two parties, you know, in the hope that we could work out some kind of a settlement. But I don't think it was ever possible.
Now, reporters and mediators, the role that you assumed at Attica, are presumed to have at least one thing in common. They're supposed to be objective. Was that a problem for you?
Yes, it was, because when I got there, I found that I was deeply involved in the negotiations, and it seemed to me that it would not have been proper for me to turn around and write about the negotiations that I was, in fact, taking part in. And so for the only time in my career as a columnist for the New York Times, I called in on Saturday morning to the paper and told them that I could not file a column.
What about later? Did your colleagues get on your back for assuming this role to begin with?
I never was worried too much about that because, you know, journalists are not privileged in that sense. If you walk past a pool and there's a child drowning, why, you should try to save the child, not take notes. And I thought I should try to help out, that it was my, not to be dramatic about it, it was my human duty, and I thought that surpassed my journalistic duty.
There's a telling bit of tape in the Court TV documentary. Essentially, you seem to be admitting to a crisis of conscience, I think. Let's hear that.
I thought to myself, I should get up and say, you guys are talking big, but what you don't understand is a lot of you are going to die. I'm not trying to tell you what to do, and I couldn't tell you what to do, but I think you ought to know the facts. These guys are going to come in here and shoot you down. Then if you want to hold out, that's fine, but you should know that. That's what I should have said. I knew I should have said that. I felt it very strongly, and I was afraid to do it.
What held you back? What were you afraid of?
Well, as you can tell here, I speak in a Southern accent, and I was a white guy. These were mostly black. There was a whole question at that time whether people were impartial negotiators or whether they were acting as representatives of the state, you know. But in retrospect, I still rather think that at least from the point of view of my own conscience, I should have said to those guys, look, you can talk about dying all you want to, but some of you, in fact, are going to die. And they did.
Did you hope that the events at Attica would shine a light on what was wrong with the prison system?
Well, yeah, I guess we're all optimists that way, and I thought maybe that writing about what could happen there and why it had happened and so forth, maybe that would be enlightening to the public. I think it's one of those journalist delusions, you know. You always think you're going to enlighten the public somehow. You really don't. But in any case, you only have to look at the statistics. At that time, in 1971, there were about 250,000 people in federal and state prisons. And now I think there's something like 2 million. Even though crime has diminished somewhat in recent years, I'm not sure that the urge to put people in prison and keep them there and throw away the key has diminished at all.
Tom Wicker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Wicker is an author and a former columnist for The New York Times. The documentary, The Ghosts of Attica, airs this Sunday at 9 p.m.
We just heard Tom Wicker describe a situation of excruciating tension for a reporter. Roger Simpson, director of the Dart Center for Journalists and Trauma, has studied the incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder in journalists. He says that eventually, practically all reporters will cover deeply disturbing events, and most do not suffer psychic damage. But certain events more easily penetrate their defenses.
We know from their accounts that they're extraordinarily troubled by incidents in which children are hurt or killed, in which there are kidnappings, in which there's hostage taking. And we also know that in the organizations in which most American journalists work, there still is relatively little attention to those individuals who may have strong traumatic reactions. Reporters have told us in surveys that had someone in the newsroom talked for even a couple of minutes about what he or she would see at an auto accident, at a fire scene, at an explosion scene, at a plane crash scene, the reporter would have been better able to handle the effects of that exposure.
And news organizations, are they bringing counselors into the newsroom? Are they making it easier for journalists to seek professional help outside the newsroom?
We hear about this in situations like the Oklahoma City bombing and the Columbine school shooting in Colorado, where the exposure of the staff is so obvious that counseling is clearly warranted. News organizations tend to respond there. But we also hear through stories of reporters and photographers that very often they're reluctant to take advantage of that. They're reluctant because they sometimes doubt there will be a confidential treatment of their access to the counselors. And they're reluctant because they don't want anyone to get the notion that they're unable to handle difficult assignments.
All right. Roger Simpson, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Roger Simpson is the director of the DART Center for Journalists and Trauma. As we heard, you don't have to be a war correspondent to catch psychic shrapnel. Take Mark Stamey, a reporter who every day pounds the death and destruction beat for the New York Post. Last fall, Brooke shadowed him on his rounds.
Stamey is short and square-faced, a middle-aged man from a broken home in Syracuse, New York. He ran his own business for a while, salvage diving. Then he went to college, earning master's degrees in sociology and journalism. He was already 45 by the time he became a reporter, freelancing first for the New York Times before landing the job at the New York Post. At the Post, he's covered fires, injured horses, fires, homicides, West Nile virus, evictions, and fires. Stamey was working the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade the day I spent with him. He pulled a sour face as Mickey Mouse, four stories high and six stories long, floated down Broadway.
I mean, that's it. The guy owns town here. Mickey Mouse took over 42nd Street. That's more than any gangster could ever do.
Stamey is cooling his heels at the parade, interviewing kids until something bigger happens. It does, and he's summoned back to the office a short walk away. He rarely writes a story by himself. In fact, he rarely writes a story. His job is to cover the story, go to the scene while another reporter is dispatched, say, to the press conference, and phone the facts, the quotes, and the color he gathers. He nurses a healthy resentment for his white-collar bosses back at the desk.
It's all right if I live in this world, but they don't want to even be brought, you know, aware of it. When I say you see, like, a dog licking human blood from the cracks of a sidewalk, I'm not inventing it. I mean, sometimes we end up walking in gore and not knowing it.
Why do you do it?
I need the job. I think I would rather not do it. I mean, I need the money. I need the job. I need the...
You need this job.
I need
at the New
job.
York Post covering babies going out of windows.
No, I don't need that. Nobody wants it. No, I don't have any joy in that. None whatsoever. I've been told on occasion I'm too stupid to write my own stories. And then the only thing I'm good for is driving the car. So they got me kind of pigeonholed as a roughneck street guy. And I don't belong inside. Let's see what delights they have for us now.
Now at the Post, Stamey is sent on another story by city editor John Mancini.
This could be a little heartwarmer.
I can't wait.
Fred Nunez is 16 years old, but just barely. Because he had a puffy jacket on, maybe not unlike yours.
Uh-huh.
And somebody did stab him for it, but they didn't get his jacket. Stabbed three times. He's in serious condition at Jamaica Hospital. Why don't you check, make sure he's still in the hospital. We're pretty sure he is, and then go see him. Maybe the family brought a turkey over and a nice new jacket for him or something.
Some bandages.
Yeah, so this could be...
Stamey climbs into his Jeep for the ride down to East New York. It's familiar territory to Stamey, the rundown districts on the city's fringes.
I spend a lot of time in a lot of these other, you know, outer boroughs.
And are you saying there's, like, there's no glamour, there's no romance, there's no sense of living your own drama in doing this kind of work?
You mean like, you know, the camera swooping around while the theme song plays in the background and here you are being grand?
Yeah.
No. No, it's all like emptying the trash cans and changing the bedpans and... No, there's no glamour in this. I can't imagine. I wouldn't be able to fantasize it being glamorous.
We arrive at the apartment house of Fred Nunez and park by a garbage pile. The building isn't locked, so we walk right in.
They're at the hospital.
They're at the hospital. That's what I thought. I think I'll go there instead. Yeah. Do you know Fred?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Does anybody else here know him? He's a, maybe talk to somebody who knows him? The neighbors?
1D.
1D? Downstairs? Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving.
He was like our cousin.
Yeah? Yeah, I heard he's a nice guy. I heard he just got up from his coat. Yeah, that's not good. We're here to help if we can.
After the interviews and a quick trip to the hospital, he phones in from an emergency room payphone to dump the quotes his editors will assemble into a story.
Yes, I do. I'm at the hospital now. We were just told that we cannot go talk to the family. But this kid's under heavy security because the perpetrators are still, apparently, they're on the loose. But I went over to his building where he lived, and I spoke to people who knew, everybody knew him. Everybody had the same thing to say about this kid, uniformly very positive. So one of the mothers in the neighborhood that knew him well, her name is Juliette, J-U-L-I-E-T-T-E, Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, said, comma, quote, he got along with everybody, dash, all the kids like him, and I like him. It's such a tragedy for a coat. I'm afraid for my own son. He has a name brand coat, too. Period, close quote. Good enough. All right, we got it then? Thank you, Andy. Is Mancini still there? Who is he the one that tells me good night? Happy Thanksgiving, Andy. Bye-bye.
Having been good-nighted by his editors, he's free to go. So we take off. There's a diner off the highway on the way from Jamaica Hospital in Queens, not far from where Stamey used to live. They all know him there. Stamey says he finds it hard to relax. He doesn't have a close-knit family or a sheltering circle of friends. In fact, and he's pretty embarrassed by this, the only regular engagements he attends are Friday night Mensa meetings. When you're covering your sixth fire in as many weeks, do you ever think to yourself, does the public really need to know about this fire? I mean...
Yeah, but then again, there's always that. Yesterday I covered a fatal fire of an NYU student who fell asleep using aromatherapy candles. You know, if you don't know about that, you think, what a benign little thing. We'll be healthy, asleep all night, have a nice glowing light there. Wake up and the whole family's dead. Seen this a lot.
But it's the other stuff. It's the catalog of miseries. You know, does that serve a social function, a positive?
Yeah. It's not just voyeurism, and it's not just intrusion so much as it is there's a need, and we can tell people about it, and then they feel it. More times than not, people have come forward to help. Especially if it's someone who's been killed, you say, what can you do? He's dead. And say, well, you want him to be forgotten? You know, just another toe tag.
You know, when I looked at your clips, fire after murder after...
train wreck after plane crash after defenestration after infanticide, parasite, homicide. I mean, come on. Whatever.
I thought, how can a person like that actually like their job? But you don't like your job.
I like it and I don't like it. The thing I like about my job is that it's infinitely challenging. It's a total 100% IQ test 100% of the time. Outwit all of New York City and get the story in the paper. What I hate is empathizing with the people whose children have been hurt. I mean, when people are just so stricken with grief that they can't talk and they can't cry, they make this sound, they call it the cri du chat, the cry of the cat. It's like a non-verbal, internalized, anguished wail that freezes in their vocal cords. And that stays with you. It, like, stains you, you know?
Back on the road, Stamey says the urban spectacles he serves up daily have earned him a twitch and many sleepless nights.
Yeah, I never want to be on that side of the story, but I live in constant fear that it's going to happen. I'm going to get shot. I think myself I'm going to get shot. I think anything can happen to anybody at any time, but we go out looking for it.
He fantasizes about moving to Florida or Tahiti, but that's not going to happen.
I wish there was a 12-step program for journalism, because it's very much like an addiction. It's an addiction because it pulls you in, it beguiles you, it hooks you, and then it starts turning you inside out. And the rush is gone, and all that's left is the hangover. The hangover and the tedium, and you're just doing it like a zombie because that's what you do every day, that's what you did every day, and it's not going to change.
Shortly after our interview last year, Stamey's anxiety escalated into full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder that kept him out of work for 8 months. Now he's back at the job, but he's still battling the symptoms.
Very tight goose flesh in a specific area, on my cheek or on my shoulder, and another area of my body starts sweating. I developed a tremendous twitch, a jerking in my head. It would be like I was being slapped on my left cheek. And that became impossible to control. It culminated in my coming to in the hospital in the intensive care unit, absolutely no memory of how I got there. I apparently had a seizure while I was driving my car on the Triborough Bridge. I sideswiped another vehicle and hit the wall of the bridge.
And did your doctor say that this might be work-related?
Yes.
In what sense?
How do you say this? I guess it was a cadaver palaver. It was nothing but just talking about bodies and everything. Incessant. It was the whole thing that there was no respite.
And how is it being back?
One thing, people treat me like I'm contagious. I've had people I was supposed to give notes to jump up and run across the newsroom to get away from me. I've had people like yelling across the newsroom about my condition. Now, here you got a doctor's appointment today. It's common knowledge.
Doesn't anybody else in the newsroom have the same experience? Have they come up to you?
Yes. This week, two people from the newsroom came up to me and asked me if I could recommend a psychiatrist for them because they were starting to react the same way, and it's starting to show on them. And they finally, at least some of them have the sense to ask.
Do you see yourself doing this for the next 5 years, 10 years?
God, what a horrible thought, huh? I mean, I can only play Indian Scout so long, and then, I got to, get off the horse and sit at my desk like a normal reporter, if there is such a thing.
Coming up, the dawn of satellite radio. Will anyone be listening?
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now for the latest installment in our Word Watch series, where we examine words that have been percolating up through the media in interesting ways. This time, it's schizophrenic, which appeared well over 100 times in various newspapers and magazines this past week alone.
A lot of the citations sound like this one from the Chicago Tribune. A Style reporter wrote, "I'm not sure if it was the fall collections for Gucci or the summer's schizophrenic weather, but July and August found me living in a sleeveless white linen top with a delicate shirred neckline, faded jeans, and rhinestone-covered sandals." Raquel Dillon explains why schizophrenic has become so stylish.
New York Daily News TV critic David Bianculli wanted to describe the inconsistent career of Spy TV's host, Michael Ian Black.
The guy does some really good stuff, like NBC's Ed, and he does some really terrible stuff.
It's a fair point, but 14 words long. Bianculli had only an inch or two for his TV highlights that week and a tight deadline. So he wrote that Black had a schizophrenic resume and stepped into a buzzword nightmare. Schizophrenic doesn't mean hot and cold, waffling, or fair-weather friend.
Schizophrenia does not mean a split personality.
Stella March is a member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
It is a very devastating illness of the brain, which causes delusions, hallucinations, poor thinking.
March runs the Stigma Busters email newsletter, which targets negative portrayals of mental illness in the media. March says the number one complaint is when people confuse multiple personality disorder with schizophrenia. The split in schizophrenia comes from its Greek root, schizo, but refers to a split with reality, a disturbing break between thoughts and emotions. Columnists, commentators, and critics often say schizophrenia when they're trying to describe erratic, contradictory behavior, and they apply it to all sorts of things, a streaky sports team, shaky financial markets, or a community's mood swings. Stanford University psychiatrist David Spiegel says psychiatry's definition of schizophrenia has changed in the last 50 years. Then in 1994, just when everyone was getting used to saying multiple personality disorder, it changed again.
And we thought the problem with multiple personality disorder was that it made it sound as though there really were eight personalities in that one person, rather than that they believed there was more than one personality.
Now the term is dissociative identity disorder, or DID. So how can a reporter with a deadline be expected to keep up? TV critic David Bianculli.
In the larger context of cranking out about 500 byline pieces a year, if I make two slips on this particular word over a two-year period, I can hold my head, if not high, I can at least walk.
If Bianculli worked for the San Francisco Chronicle instead of the New York Daily News, his review of Spy TV would have run afoul of the Chronicle's style book. Editorial page editor John Diaz enforces the paper's policy.
Well, in the Chronicle style book, actually, this is flagged as a word that should be used carefully and with precision. In fact, the exact words in our style book is, this is a clinical term, do not misuse as a synonym for contradictory.
The Chronicle refers to Merriam-Webster's. Georgetown linguistics professor Colleen Cotter turns to the American Heritage Dictionary.
One of their definitions, the second definition, is that it's a situation or condition that results from the coexistence of disparate or antagonistic qualities, identities, or activities. And then the example sentence that they give is, the national schizophrenia that results from carrying out an unpopular war.
Cotter says language is performing its natural function by appropriating schizophrenic for general use. The word's meaning changes in the process, and this happens a lot with technical terms.
It sums up situations so nicely. If there's not another word that just does the trick, you'll borrow a word. So you can think of it as a borrowing from a profession.
According to Cotter, it might be too late to save schizophrenia from its new non-technical meaning. But for writers like Bianculli, it's lazy journalism to give in to those colloquialisms.
I do think it's worse than ignorance to be aware that you're not using something exactly and to use it anyway.
The ancients once saw a battle between good and evil within. Now psychiatry sees neurotransmitters out of whack. But the idea of two people at cross purposes caught in the same body still captures the imagination, and the word schizophrenic embodies that idea. For On the Media, I'm Raquel Maria Dillon.
This week, yet another new technology comes to market. It's satellite radio, beamed to specially equipped cars and homes across the country. The first company out of the gate is XM Satellite Radio, which begins its rollout in Dallas-Fort Worth and San Diego. XM's 100 channels of programming will reach most people directly from satellites. The rest will get it from 1,000 repeater towers, if the FCC gives its approval. From Washington, On the Media's Neil Carruth reports.
Lee Abrams is XM's chief programming officer. He sees a striking similarity between the FM radio of 2001 and the AM of the early 1970s. Abrams says FM stations, which were once a hip, youth-oriented departure from AM, have lost their edge.
FMs aren't part of the audio standard, which is digital. FMs are running a lot of commercials. FMs really have only a handful of formats. FM's not part of the whole cell phone, Palm Pilot, internet, digital revolution, and it's just kind of an older technology. And finally, FM is tired. The playbook hasn't been rewritten in years.
According to Abrams, FM is creatively vulnerable, and that's where satellite radio comes in.
In the medium and long run, it's definitely going to be a content game. So we want to come out of the box not only with great technical sound, but phenomenal programming.
XM subscribers who pay $9.99 per month can listen to 71 music channels and 29 talk channels. Channels on the music side include heavy metal, bluegrass, modern jazz, Tejano, opera, reggae, all of them providing 24 hours of programming, 7 days a week. Abrams says one of his favorites is XMU.
Corner Shop. Last time you'll ever hear us say Corner Shop unless Corner Shop comes out with a new song, because Corner Shop doesn't have anything new and we're all about new, so Corner Shop, Room Full of Asha, is done. We've killed it.
XMU is an alternative format. It's really college radio, but it's professionally done. A lot of college stations, you know, really are a couple guys bringing their girlfriends, getting drunk and just screwing around playing records. But this is college radio like it should be.
Many of the talk channels are joint ventures with broadcasters like CNN, Bloomberg, and Disney. Most will feature audio feeds of existing programs. XM does have two partnerships to produce original talk programming, one with USA Today and one with auto racing giant NASCAR.
NASCAR Today is produced by MRN Radio.
Dale Jarrett now inching even closer. He thought about helping give Skinner a little shove through the corner, but this is not the time to make those kind of moves.
The big question for XM is whether anyone will pay for all these choices, when radio currently offers consumers some choice at no cost. Hugh Panero, XM's president and CEO, remembers the naysayers in the early days of pay television.
I was there helping to build the pay-per-view industry, where somebody said, well, nobody's going to want to pay for a movie for the convenience and the kind of presentation that that would give when they can go to the video store or go watch a movie or watch it on HBO. But you know what? People buy movies and they buy wrestling and boxing.
Don't expect satellite radio to reach the subscription levels of pay TV anytime soon. Panero says XM will break even if it has 4 million subscribers by 2004. But radio is different, says Michael Kelly, a telecommunications professor at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Kelly spent years in local radio and says a national service like XM violates one of the medium's basic principles. Radio works best when it's local.
What people look for when they listen to radio is local traffic, local weather, local news, which even the syndicated stations provide some of, and the big chains in the major cities still have their local weather and their local traffic. These guys won't be able to provide that from the satellite. They won't have a clue.
XM programming chief Lee Abrams.
We're local, too. It's just our market is all of America. I think the best radio talks to the listener and is always relating to people and places, and good radio station, if it's in Chicago, should talk to Chicagoans. For us, it's critically important to talk to America.
Abrams says XM is designed to serve the underserved in every market. For example, a salsa fan isolated in Duluth. In order to get the service, you'll need to upgrade or replace your car's audio system or buy a car already outfitted with an XM-capable radio. Each car will need a tuner, a receiver, and an antenna at a cost of several hundred dollars. But even after spending all that money, you'll still have to sit through commercials. XM's Lee Abrams.
Nothing wrong with commercials. We love commercials enough already. You've got to know when to stop.
XM will draw the line at about 4 to 6 minutes of commercials per hour on about half of the 71 music channels. That's much lower than most broadcast stations. The rest of the music channels will be commercial-free, but all of the talk channels will have commercials. George Mason's Michael Kelly says channels with ads could be a potential turnoff.
You know, in cable, you get the box free, but my goodness, to pay $300 to $500 for a radio and pay $10 to $13 a month and then have to listen to ads, I'm not sure anybody's going to go for that.
XM's corporate ties extend beyond advertising. It signed agreements with manufacturers and retailers, and most important of all, a distribution deal with the world's largest automaker, General Motors. 2002 Cadillac DeVilles and Sevilles will carry XM radios as a factory-installed option. Chip Lindsay is president of Lindsay Cadillac in Alexandria, Virginia.
We're all about selling cars. I mean, I'm not here to sell radio. But if selling a radio, an XM, is a fine match for a Cadillac, and if that can enhance you know, our customers' buying experience, and that's what we're all about.
Cadillac customers at Lindsay this week aren't sold yet.
That would be something I'd probably be interested in after checking into it a little bit.
You know, I don't listen to radio that much, so I don't think it would be anything that would be beneficial to me.
I could get in my car and drive to work, and all I have is commercials all the way to the office without hearing any music, so that bothers me.
Pay for radio? Are you serious? I don't think so.
XM will spend $45 million on advertising later this year, but it may not be enough to overcome the public's financial jitters, says Jeffrey York of trade publication Radio and Records.
They're going to need to get an immediate hit from the American public, and they're battling with the timing of the economy. If the downtrend in the U.S. economy continues, I think it's going to be harder for them to bring in subscribers and to make it work.
But York also says that Americans are all too willing to add yet one more gadget to their lives and pay one more bill each month.
If you take a look at your household budget in America in 2001 and compare it to what was being spent in the average household budget in 1945, I think you'll be stunned at the number of categories that we today spend money on, the things that we find that we need.
In December, XM will have competition when Sirius satellite radio becomes commercially available, with another 100 channels. The challenge will be to convince Americans to pay for a service they don't yet think they need. For On the Media, I'm Neil Carruth in Washington.
And the video of the year goes to Lady Marmalade, Christina Aguilera.
On Thursday night, MTV handed its Video of the Year award to a song first recorded 26 years ago, featured in a movie set 100 years ago, populated by characters employed in the world's oldest profession. But MTV isn't necessarily fixated on the past. It is changing, and what once set the network apart, videos, has been de-emphasized in favor of programming one might find on traditional networks. But the last people to realize this change has occurred have been the recording artists themselves. Joining me now to discuss the phenomenon is James Sirwicki, columnist for The New Yorker magazine. Welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
MTV was built on the premise of getting promotional videos from record companies for free and playing them for a young audience eager to see the same numbers again and again and again. But now MTV's reliance on videos has greatly diminished. What's going on?
This actually dates back a while, which is that MTV realized that even though people love videos and even though MTV's identity is completely wrapped up with showing videos, people actually don't like to sit and just watch videos. And that makes sense. I mean, you know, mostly when you watch videos, you'll switch. If you like the song, you'll watch it. If not, you'll switch to something else, which is good if you're watching, but it's bad if you're an advertiser. So MTV realized that if it was going to be able to grow and continue to, you know, take in ad revenue, it needed to play fewer videos, and it needed to make shows that people would watch.
So an increasing supply of videos is meeting a diminishing demand for them.
Exactly.
Something's got to give. What's giving?
Well, the only thing that really seems to be giving is the record labels are, you know, spending a lot of money trying to market records, the videos for which never get played on the air. The record labels are basically locked into the idea that MTV is the place to break new acts, which it is for some acts. But for a lot of people, you know, MTV is just this wasteland because their videos are never going to get on.
Do you have any idea what percentage of videos that are made find their way onto MTV's air?
It's hard to say just because there's, you know, there is no institute that tracks this kind of data, but the estimates are that somewhere between, say, 50 and 60% of the videos that get made never actually make it onto MTV proper.
Wow, and do you know what they're paying to film a video these days?
The average video, you know, with a major label, and of course the major labels put out something like 85% of the music, basically, costs somewhere around $250,000. And that's for a pretty normal, you know, simple video. I mean, one of the paradoxes of this also is that the harder it is to get on MTV, the more money the labels spend on these videos in order to get on MTV. Because the idea is to have a chance, you have to kind of do something special, basically. So MTV is really in the perfect position. I mean, it's, you know, it basically has this endless supply of high-quality videos, and it only has to play, you know, the percentage of them that it wants.
Well, on the face of it, it sounds like a very bad bet for the record industry. They would seem to do better by getting in the car, going to Vegas, and putting $250,000 on black. Do they have to take this gamble? Can you have a hit record without a video to accompany it?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. The argument tends to be that you can, actually, that there are a lot of people within the industry who think that the idea that a video is essential is sort of overrated, and that, you know, word of mouth and radio play are still really the key factors. The problem is that word of mouth and even radio play are sort of harder. The impact of those is a little bit harder to measure. But there is one other problem in all this, which is that the artists themselves want to be on MTV, and not necessarily for economically rational reasons. You know, it's just that being on MTV is this, you know, it's a crucial part of what it means to be a star now. And it's hard to convince artists, I think, to give that up.
How much do the artists want to have videos?
The artists really want to have videos. And it's typically in a typical record contract, the label will commit to making at least one video. And if it's a big artist, then they'll pretty much commit to making videos for all the singles. And so as a result, the label ends up committing to a video in advance. You know, the artist definitely wants that video. Time comes around. Even if the label says to itself, you know what, this video is just going to be a waste of money, it's sort of contractually committed. So, you know, the sensible thing for them to do is to cut back significantly on the number of videos they make.
Apart from the ratings advantage of showing programs like The Real World, for example, as opposed to just a string of music videos, is there some advantage to MTV to actually limit the number of videos in order to make the time slots allotted to them more valuable? You know, like OPEC cutting back on oil production?
It's not exactly clear that MTV, I mean, when you talk to people at MTV, no one says, you know, we consciously decided to do this as a way of maximizing our power over the record industry. But certainly that has been one effect. The other thing is, I have this strange theory that I think MTV2 was created in part to convince the record labels that they should continue making videos. Because MTV is only in that great position of power if the record companies keep making all these videos.
All right, James Sirwicki, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
James Sirwicki is a columnist for The New Yorker.
Hi, Mom. Thank you to everybody that thought we'd make good whores. Appreciate it. Thank you. We're taking the Moon Man home.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Melissa Sanford, engineered by Scott Strickland, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Rex Doan and the Lou Rawls of National Public Radio, Mr. Brian Naylor. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media, if you haven't guessed by now, from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And for On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield of On the Media.
On the Media was brought to you by the Bidell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.